Hello and welcome to episode 55 of A Fortnight in Film. I'm your host, Jason.
I'm your co-host, George.
And I'm your co-co-host, Jacob.
Thanks for tuning in. Your first pick of the year, actually, George, this is.
Is it? Yeah. Uh-huh. I think I picked a good one.
Yes, I think you did.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like I'm off to a good start with yours. Usually, you know,
it's because it's the narratively sound,
yes,
straightforward drama.
I know. Well, so, good. You're learning.
That's why I'm learning.
What's everybody been watching? Anything of interest? Anything of note?
I've been doing a couple of like challenges on Letterboxd.
I was going to ask you about this, actually, because I saw you were... I mean, I have a Criterion challenge I know you sort of do every year, but then I saw you were doing another challenge.
Yeah, it's called... I just found it. It's called the Film School Dropouts Challenge. And it's basically just... It's like 50 different sort of categories, ranging from like directors or genres or... It's meant to sort of get you... I mean, I watch quite a wide variety anyway, but it's meant to get you watching quite a wider sort of variety of stuff. So yeah, it's been good. I've done like five so far. I think the last one was watch a film from a writer that was blacklisted by Hollywood during the whole McCarthy era stuff, and that was Mr. Arkadin by Wells, which was good. So yeah, it's fun. And then the Criterion Challenge is, yeah, that's just standard. They have a lot of different categories with that as well, so been working my way through that one.
That's a fitting, I guess, what's the word, like, topic for the film for that other challenge, because obviously the film we're discussing today deals in part with blacklisting and, you know, communist suspicions.
I was thinking so that actually.
It's good timing, actually, that you...
And apart from that, I've sort of had a pause a bit on my Hong Kong binge. Not because I've sort of fallen out of love with it or anything. I've just wanted a sort of a change of tone. Yeah. So I've sort of, apart from the ones we've watched for the podcast next week, I've sort of put a pause on it. And yeah, one that's made an impression on me is it's called Rosetta, by a pair of Belgian brothers called the Dardennes. And it was quite funny. Like, my mum heard me watching it, and there was a scene where it was really sad. I wasn't like crying or anything, but I was like, no, please, no. And she was like, why do you watch these like depressing films? Like, don't they just make you sad? And I was like, yes, but they're good. But that's like, it doesn't matter that they're sad. They're good films. She was like, it's just pointless. And I was like, no.
I feel like you need your own like private screening room to avoid
comments
from your mum and your sister. Well, and you.
I was watching that in my room, but the problem is my door was open and she was like walking by, so she heard.
How dare she invade the sanctity of your private room?
How dare she? How dare she ruin my film watching? I know.
Well, at least it's not pornography or anything.
That's true. Yeah, it's pornography versus an art house Belgian film. So,
yeah,
you know,
disgusting.
Yeah, I mean, some of those probably could be classed as pornography. True.
It's art house, yeah. And it's Belgian.
Art house.
Belgian.
Yeah, I know.
Gross.
Just
Jason walking past. Get some porn on your screen. Yeah. Come on, man.
Jason would be like, George, put something more mainstream on. Come on.
Yeah. What a square.
But yeah.
I'm kidding.
So yeah, that's my recent film watching. What about you guys?
Well, episode 54, I know I spoke about a couple of Shirley Temple films that I had watched recently. And the person I'm about to mention, I know you are a big fan of, George. I've been watching a couple of Humphrey Bogart films recently. I have seen a few before. So I'd obviously seen Casablanca, gave it 5 stars, as you have to do, because it is an amazing film. Maltese Falcon, I've seen 4 stars. Sabrina, 4 stars. The African Queen was 3.5 stars. That was a good film. And recently I'd watched Key Largo from 1948, which was actually directed by John Huston, who was sort of more famous for his, I don't know, I was going to say Westerns, but then I always get him confused. I always get John Huston confused with John Ford. I always think of the same person, and I'm like, no, it isn't.
Yeah, no, John Huston, he did some Westerns, but he did a mix of sort of dramas.
Because I can see his director filmography is quite varied, right? He has like The Maltese Falcon and The African Queen, like Key Largo. But then he also has like And the Treasure of Sierra Madre, which is also Humphrey Bogart. But then he has like Annie from 1982, or like Casino Royale, which is a Bond film.
Yeah. From the 60s. And I think he worked into the sort of new Hollywood era. Yeah. Like he worked into the 70s, where a lot of directors from the classic age didn't. So he's quite interesting in that regard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Key Largo was a very good film. I gave that 4 stars with Lauren Bacall, obviously, was his wife, and I don't know if they were married at that time, I'm sure they were, and Edward G. Robinson. So that was a very good film. It's very, if you haven't seen it, I'm not going to spoil it, but it's a very simple premise, you know. I don't know if you'd agree with that, but there's a lot of, you know, tension and interest. And
yeah, twists. I mean, I need to rewatch it. I think I saw it like maybe two years ago now. I remember the sort of stormy, it's like set during a storm, right? So I love the sort of atmosphere and the way it was shot with the storm. And
yeah, it's very much noir, very in that noir sense. Mm-hmm. So that was very good. And then I watched, which I thought was good, but when I looked at the Letterbox rating, I was like, wow, that's a really high rating. So I watched In a Lonely Place from 1950.
Yeah, that was a little stab to my heart when I saw it. I'm glad it wasn't lower, but I was like, because it's like, I think you liked my review that I wrote, I think, because it's my all-time favorite noir. It's like number one for me. And I think it's on a 4.3.
Yeah, so it's 4.2, so it's up there as like it could be in the top 250, yeah. You know. And I expected to like it because it's directed by Nicholas Ray, who did Rebel Without a Cause, which I love. He did Johnny Guitar, which I thought was a good film. He's done, what's the other film I've seen? Oh, 55 Days at Peking, but I haven't seen that in many years, and I need to revisit it. So I expected to like it, and I did like it. Like, it was a good film, but when I went on Letterboxd and it was like 4.2 average, I was like, was it that good? You know, I don't know.
Yes,
I
mean, yes,
you tell
yes,
me. Maybe I just didn't get it, because like,
what's not what sort of?
Well, okay, well, okay. I'll flip the question. What makes you give it 5 stars?
Partly, it's Bogart's performance. I mean, I think it's the best in his whole career. From what I've
heard that from other people.
Gloria Graham, I love it as well. She's one of the best sort of female leads in a noir, femme fatales, whatever you want to call it. I just think the script is just very clever, very, very tightly written. It's the ending just leaves you speechless every time. It's so tense. It's one of the tensest endings for me. You're just like, no. But the whole film is just it's so well constructed. I just love it every time. But I mean, yeah, it's due a rewatch for me. I think I last saw it again like a year and a half ago. But yeah, maybe it's due a rewatch for you in the future. Maybe your opinion might change.
Oh yeah,
never know.
Or maybe, yeah, because I mean, I do feel like I was missing something when all these people were like, "Oh my god, it's amazing! It's one of like the best films ever." I was like, it was a good film, but I was like, I didn't. So I looked up afterwards, like, what, you know? And I think it was adapted from something. I don't know if it was a play or a novel or something. And so I looked up like for themes and everything, and it was talking about, you know, like masculinity, I guess, and
simplifying.
Well, I know. I'm just trying to think of like some of the recurring things I read and all this stuff I read about what did it mean, you know, and like marriage and relationships and violence and, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I said I enjoyed it. It was a good film. I was just surprised when I went on Letterboxd and I saw how hard everybody else rated. I thought, oh.
To be fair, that's probably the case with the majority of the films you...
No, it was true, but it's also like most of the time I'm at the complete opposite end of the scale. I'm giving something a 0.5 star and it's got a 4.2.
True.
Anyway, that was a good film. So yes, all 6 Humphrey Bogart films I've seen, I have enjoyed so far. And I'm just looking if there's any others that I own that I haven't yet seen. One is The Barefoot Contessa from 1954. One is called Beat the Devil from 1953. And the other one is called The Heart of a Fall from 1956. So hopefully I will continue to enjoy them. But yes, I would say that of that classic Hollywood era, Humphrey Bogart has probably emerged as one of my favorite, if not my favorite actor from that period. So
nice. Well, he's up there in most people's, you know, top five, 10 for them.
Well, I think the AFI put him at number one, didn't they, as the best actor ever from that period. So
what about you, Jacob? Yes. Anything interesting?
Last week I watched the original Candyman from 1992. I thought it was fantastic. I thought the originality, like, because, you know, a hook for a hand, say Candyman in the mirror five times, like, all that's an overdone trope. But the whole idea of this guy that has bees coming out of his mouth, he has all this trauma, how he died. Yeah, good. And
I think I have it at 3.5 stars, because I watched it with my sister ages ago, and she thought it was good, but she didn't really get it. But I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I'm staying away from the remake.
I mean, the remake, so I mean, the original was sitting at a 3.6, and the remake sitting at a 3.1. So it isn't, I guess, awful by the community standard.
I've heard it sort of, it's a bit more without resorting to sort of, I don't know, it's a bit more PC, let's put it that way. It's a bit more focused on sort of politics and identity stuff. Whereas the original is just a straight up good horror, I think, which is what I prefer.
The actor who did it, Tony Todd, actor Tony Todd. There you go. He was Candyman, and just his voice, like lurking around, and you just hear
it's so it deep, isn't it?
Gives you chills. You know, it just works so well.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that was a fantastic movie. I've been wanting to watch that one for a while. Finally got it on Blu-ray. Another one I watched since one of our last episodes is Crackers, which I found on, I think...
Oh, my recommendation that I...
Yeah.
That I gave
SBS you. On Demand. Demand.
Well, I should hope so. I mean, it's an Australian film, so you think they'd have it. Now, what did you think of it?
Yeah, funny movie. A couple of moments were a bit shocking, like, because it's like an Australian movie, very Australian movie, more Australian than... Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, I'd argue. But the acting wasn't so great, but it just doesn't matter. You know, there was some warmth in there with the story.
Yeah, right. It was one of those films, like, the story is so funny, the acting doesn't need to be great. You don't watch that film for its acting. And watch
Although, I guess I would recommend it to other Australians, but there's other movies out there for people outside of Australia. Like, I would say Crackers is one of those sort of hidden gems, but this, like, watch something like, you know, The Castle or what was the other one again?
Muriel's Wedding
before you watch Crackers, for example, because that they're much more quality movies. Right.
Is there a reason why Crackers has only 261 views on Letterboxd? As in, like, is it way more popular in Australia?
I think it's generally quite an obscure film.
It's very niche.
It's quite an obscure film.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Unless they just tried to hide it because there's a scene where the kid, I forget the names, the kid is, what's the kid's name? Is it Joey? Joey Dredge? Their surname's Dredge. So Joey the kid, like, he hates Bruno, which is his sort of, like, not really stepdad, it's his mum's boyfriend. And he, what is it, flings some kind of something at, I can't remember the scene exactly. Terrible at explaining this scene. But anyway, the dog ends up flying over the top of a barbecue that's been doused in lawnmower fuel and burns to an absolute crisp. And then you just see the dog's body just fall on the ground, completely pitch black. It's like his grandfather's dog. And, yeah, like, it's very shocking. It does have the comedic value to it, but yeah, probably not good for some people. No animal cruelty.
Yeah, Pessa wouldn't like that. No.
So there's moments like that that are like, holy shit. And it is funny. There's other funny moments. But then there's like also some wholesomeness in there, like closer to the end, like with the Scottish grandfather, like I think it's his great grandfather or something. So I won't ruin the ending or anything. We're not really discussing that from head to toe, but it is a fun movie. It's again, there's fun and there's good. Like it's good in the way that it's fun, but then there's also like Jason's idea of like just, it doesn't matter if it's fun or not. It's either good or it's bad.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would say Crackers was a fun movie, but I'd say it's also a good movie. But yeah, well, anyway, I'm glad you liked it because it is, you know.
I'm glad that you brought it to my attention. So
yeah, I know it's an obscure thing.
It is a little bit.
Said, really it's few crazy. People have seen it. So
So that's a couple of movies I've watched recently.
Let's get into the film, which is your pick, George. So I will hand it over to you.
For once, Jason was happy because it's a rather straight-laced, you know, historical narrative drama.
Yes, more like this.
No, because then every week would be the same. So no, we need to keep switching it up.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But having said that, I did love this film. So yeah. So it's The Lives of Others. German from 2006, directed by, I won't say his full name. Well, I can say his full name.
It's a long one.
I think it's like, I'll say the short one. It's Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck.
He sounds so very important. Like German nobility. Henkel von
Donnersmarck. Yeah, he know his, I was reading up about him, his nobility from Silesia, which is in the far east of Germany. And he actually, I'll get a bit into it, but his parents were actually from East Germany. So like when he was doing his research and sort of inspiration, it was sort of sparked because his parents were under surveillance by the Stasi, and that like sparked his interest. But anyway, but it's basically in 1980, is it 84 or 85?
I think 84.
East Germany. We have a Stasi. On Wikipedia, it says Hauptmann, which I think is a captain, which is a captain. So a Stasi captain called Gerd Weissler. He's basically ordered by his superior, who's a colonel, Anton Grubitz, to spy on a playwright called Georg Dreimann, whose sort of pro-communist policies and international recognition have sort of kept the state from directly monitoring him. And Dreimann's sort of appearance as a model East German citizen mystifies Grubitz because he has no known vices or record of disloyalty or dissent or sort of anything like that. So Weissler and his team bug the apartment, set up a surveillance equipment, and start to report Dreimann's activities. And Weissler then learns that Dreimann's surveillance is at the request of the Minister of Culture, Bruno Hempf, who wants Dreimann's girlfriend, who's an actress, called Christa Seeland. And after an intervention by Visa leads to Dreimann's discovering Seeland's relationship with Hempf, he basically implores her not to meet him again and reshoot herself when she sort of reconciles with Dreimann. What is going on? Dreimann has a friend called Jeska, who was a blacklisted director, who gives him sheet music for is called Sonata for a Good Man, which will be important later on. And then Jeska hangs himself. Sad moment, rip. And then Dreimann basically gets together with his other theatre friends and publishes an anonymous article in a West German newspaper called Der Spiegel, basically accusing the state of concealing the country's elevated suicide rates. And when Dreimann and his friends sort of feign a attempt to sort of get this across the border to determine whether his flat is bugged, Weissler, who's starting to be more sympathetic to him, doesn't report it, and the conspirators basically think they're safe. And then he basically hides the typewriter under the keyboard because it's like a special typewriter that has like red ink, so he like can't be identified and stuff. I'm trying to hurry it up. But and then, so Dreyer's article angers East Germany, obviously, because it can't be traced to a registered typewriter, and rejected by Sealand. Hempf orders Grubitz to arrest her, and then she's blackmailed to reveal Dreyman's authorship of the article, although the Stasi don't find it because Wiesler has basically hidden the sort of a typewriter. And then, yeah, so when the Stasi return to Dreyman's apartment and all this is happening, Krista realizes that Dreyman will know she betrayed him and sort of flees into the street and is hit by a truck and dies. Grubitz then finds nothing beneath the floorboard. Wiesler, I said, having removed the typewriter. And then Grubitz then basically tells Wiesler that he's sacked, basically, because he sort of knows that he's been sort of sympathetic and meddling, although there's no proof, he knows that he's been meddling with it. And his last years will be in Department M, which is like a bottom floor cellar job, basically. And then that same day, Gorbachev is elected leader of the Soviet Union in 1984, I think, yeah, five. And then 4 years later, 1989, Wiesler is sort of steam opening sort of letters in his dull job. And then the fall of the Berlin Wall comes over the radio. And then he sort of gets up and sort of leaves the office. And then 2 years later, there's sort of a series of small epilogues, basically. So then 2 years later, Hempf and Dreyman meet at a performance of Dreyman's play, sort of each reflecting on their life before and after the reunification. Dreyman asks why he was never monitored by the Stasi, to which Hempf replies that he has been, and they sort of knew everything. And Dreyman then finds all the wires in his apartment and sort of rips them all out. And then he basically goes to review his Stasi files at the records agency. And he's confused by all the sort of contradictions in all the reports and starts to realize that Wiesler was sympathetic sort of all along. And then he sees a fingerprint in red in a final report and realizes that the sort of officer must have removed the typewriter from his apartment. And then he tracks down Wiesler, but ultimately decides not to approach him or sort of say anything. And then 2 years later again, Wiesler passes a bookshop promoting Dreyman's new novel called Sonata for a Good Man, which is where it comes in from earlier. He opens a copy of the book and discovers that it's dedicated to HGW-XX7, which was his sort of code when he was in the Stasi. And it says to HGW-XX7 in gratitude. And then as he buys a copy, he's asked if he'd like it gift wrapped. And he says, no, it's for me. And that's the... Sorry, I thought I ranted, but that was the... It's quite a long film.
Yeah, no, I was totally digging it.
That's the plot. That's the plot. So yeah, there we go. No, I'll just say I gave it 5 stars off the bat. I thought it was a masterpiece.
Well, Letterboxd agrees with you. You know, it's sitting at a 4.3 average, number 161 in the top 250. This was one of the, and not that I'm like, you know, like completely well versed in the top 250, but I'd like to think most films in there, like I've seen 95 on there, right? So I've seen 30 something percent, I'm guessing. And the others I haven't seen, I'm like, I know of, I've heard of. I hadn't actually heard of this film, which surprised me given how sort of highly it's acclaimed. I'd never even heard of it before you picked it.
I'll go into a lot of the reasons after, I guess. But what did you guys... I know what you rated it, Jason. But you gave it 4 stars, didn't you?
I did give it 4 stars.
Yeah, so you liked it?
Yes, no, I thought it was a great film. I don't... it's sort of like, again, sort of like in a Lonely Place for me, where I'm like, I see the rating of 4.3, and I'm like, it was a great film, like 4 stars. I'm like, it didn't move into that, like I said, 5-star, wow, it's one of the best films ever thing for me. But I thought it was a very good film. I can't really fault anything with it. I mean, I thought the acting was great across the board. I thought the score was great. I thought the cinematography was great. I thought the story was just this very, like, gripping, tense thing that was, like, full of intrigue and mystery and what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I mean, it was so tense. because it's like the constant rate of discovery by like Wiesler. Like, you don't know, as his character changes, you sort of get a sense that he's getting more sympathetic as the film goes on, but there are some scenes where you don't know if he's going to change and like report them. Like, that's where the tension comes from, you know. It's a sort of cat and mouse.
Yeah, it's one of those films, like, and there's others like this. Like, I think of something like The Father from a few years ago. Like, I gave it 4 stars, but I even said in my review for that, and I'm like, I could give it 5 stars, so I can't find anything wrong with it. So it's sort of a similar thing with this film. I'm like, I can't really find anything wrong with it. I mean, to that point, like, I liked that evolution of the Stasi captain. It wasn't just, and I've got a point later which we can come back to, but like, it wasn't, it didn't just happen, right? It wasn't like one day he was this, you know, I was going to say Nazi, but they're not the Nazis, are they? He was this, you know, Stasi captain. He was very much, you know, pro, I was going to say Russia, but it isn't Russia, pro
socialist,
pro Soviet, you know, pro socialist.
GDR is the state.
Yeah. You know, and then the next day it was, oh no, like, it obviously happened over the course of a film, which I think felt a lot more authentic. Because I've not seen anything else by this director, I think, but in a lesser director's hands, it maybe would have happened, you know, instantaneously for the sake of the plot, which would have just ruined it, really. It would have just lost its.
No, it's good because, like, at the start of the film, you sort of, you know, you see him in his flat, which is like empty, and the, like, the food he eats. I don't know why I brought that up, but it's like ketchup with rice or something. It's so, like, his life is so sort of basic and like boring. He's like part of the system, you know. And then, like, as he becomes more deeply immersed, he starts to question the morality of, you know, what he's doing, because he sees people who are actually in love. He sees a flat which is nicely furnished with all the nice Western stuff in it. And that's why his views sort of start to change, because he gets more sort of humanity seeping into his bones, you know. And then there are a couple of scenes that just, as we're on him, I just wanted to mention, there's a couple of scenes I loved, which is when he's listening to Drayman play the piano. And Drayman says it's something like, anyone who is a bad person, like, won't enjoy listening to this music or something. Do you remember that scene? And then upstairs, you can tell Wiesler is enjoying the piece. So you know at that point, he's a good person. And then straight after that, he gets in the lift with that little boy. And because the little boy, like, kicks the football sort of in there. And then the little boy starts to say that his father thinks that the GDR is like a bad nation who does bad things. And Wiesler starts to say, what's the name of your, and then stops and then says, and then the boy is like, what were you saying? He's like, what's the name of your ball? Which makes makes no sense. But it's sort of his conscience. Then you can tell he is a good man, but he's just been sort of crushed by this socialist GDR sort of system where he can't escape from. And then there's another scene which I loved, where he's listening in to them, to Krista and Drayman on the bed. They're like hugging on the bed, sort of embracing, and then it cuts to him. He's like pretending to be hugged upstairs. Do you know what scene I'm talking about? And it's like, it's sort of humorous in a sort of sad way. It's like he's trying to imagine himself with someone like that, but he's like in this cold, abandoned attic upstairs, and they're together downstairs in a nice, you know, warm apartment. So it's like he's wishing that he could be like Drayman. It's like jealousy almost. And then obviously his redemption comes at the end, and then he's, because of his act of defiance, he's you know, shoved down to the bottom of the pile, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that ending, I thought the ending was great, because I didn't see it coming. You know, like, I thought it was the woman, until you get to the bit where you realize, oh, it's him. You know, like, so maybe some people sort of had it telegraphed and they sort of figured, oh, I knew it is. But it caught me off guard, so I liked
that. But did you miss, though? You knew that he did move the typewriter, because you see him walking out of the apartment building holding it.
Maybe I missed that. I don't know.
Did you miss that? Yeah, you do. You Drayman comes back into the complex, and then Fiesler is standing in the corner, sort of hiding. And then as he walks out, you see him holding the typewriter.
It's probably good I missed that in a sense, because it made the ending more effective. So
yeah, well, it was a prize for you. Yeah. And also Krista, there's no way Krista could have moved it because she was being held by the secret police.
I did think that, but then I figured when she went out to like kill herself, I figured, oh, it must have been her. So anyway, when I got to the ending and it was like, and it was him, I was like, oh, wow, that's such a good twist. You know?
I think she killed herself just because of like the overall shame of ratting them out in the first place. But we can go into all that. Jacob, what did you think?
I thought it was a very solid movie. Yeah, pretty much mimic everything that Jason just said.
What would you rate it?
Probably about 4. To be honest, that ending where she's hit by a car, I didn't even realize that she was doing it on purpose. I thought she was actually running to you know, and then she was hit, and I was, until you mentioned it. So that sort of ruined it for me, because I was like, you know, so far it's really good. There's a couple of other moments I want to touch on, but I was like, what? She just gets hit by a car and that's it? Like, what the?
But, yeah, it's a guilt, just a guilt, you know? She couldn't handle it. I mean, her character is very interesting because obviously, you know, she's being forced into this relationship with this fat old, you know, GDR guy who's sort of disgusting. And the moment she shows some sort of self-agency and says no, he basically, you know, she's taking illegal meds, basically. He gets her arrested, and then that's her life pretty much over. So it just shows, like, the scope of the sort of power and control that the Starseed had over literally anyone. Like, you did anything, and your life was over. It's crazy. And that's one of the themes in the film, which I love, the sort of the showing the sort of power that the Starseed have over even the neighbor, you know, when Weissler is seen coming out of the flat, he says to her, you know, your daughter's place at university is going to be taken away if you say anything, which is like mental.
And that's the fact, like, they're obviously surveying everybody to such an extent. He knows who the neighbor is to threaten her about a daughter, you know what I mean? Because, like,
straight away.
Yeah.
He called her by name, didn't he? It's like he knows who she is. It's just, yeah, everything is so like tightly sort of paced and written to like show exactly the nature of this authoritarian regime.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think the film did very well at like, and I'm sure people who lived in Eastern Germany or other like, you know, communist states at that time could speak to this better than I, of course. I think, or is it communist or socialist? I get so confused. So
both. It's both. It's a socialist state, but it's communism in practice. Socialism is communism. Anyway.
Yeah. I know, but then it's confusing because the Nazis were like national socialists.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, we won't go down that rabbit hole. But my point is, I felt it portrayed that sort of culture of fear of the time very well, of like I said, this constant state of suspicion, people getting arrested for no reason, being spied on. You know, it was, I think of, and without wanting to inject too many politics into this, but I think of, you know, all these people who say, oh, we'd be so much better under communism, capitalism is awful, we hate capitalism. Okay, go and live in East Germany in the 80s, see how much you like communism. Have fun having all your conversations recorded. Have fun having your whole house wiretapped. Have fun being spied on 24/7. Enjoy. Have fun.
Yeah, and there was a good scene which highlighted that, actually, when Wiesler, he walked into like the canteen with his boss, and all the superiors are sitting at the other table, and Wiesler's, the boss says something like, oh, like, why don't you go sit with like the sort of superiors? And he's like, oh, what sort of a socialist country is this? Sort of a comment along those lines, where everyone's meant to be equal in a socialist state, right? And you have the bosses sitting on a separate table to the grunts. And it's like, that's not the same sort of ideal society that you want. And also, a nice touch, I don't know if you noticed, you know, that the young guy who was telling a joke about the leader, and then the other guy was like, ha ha ha, and then like went along with it and then said, oh no, I'm not going to demote you, like, don't be honest. That same guy was in the cellar at the end with Weissler. So he obviously was, he like was demoted in the end just for telling a joke about the leader. And it's like, it's so any comment like that will just set you back, and then you're down in the cellar, you know. It's crazy. And another theme I wanted to say is about sort of art and expression, because like the whole sort of artistic expression is a theme in the film with Drayman, because he sort of represents sort of intellectual sort of freedom and sort of creativity, and it sort of celebrates the role of art as a form of sort of resistance and asserting individuality, because, you know, he's a theater director, and he can't, and his friend kills himself because he's been blacklisted, he's a director. So in these regimes, if you're an artist, you can't freely express what you want to, you know, in the face of censorship, repression and all that. So it's like, you know, not just a theater director, it could be a actual, you know, like a painter or a musician or a film director, anyone. You were just shut down. And it must have been so tempting to try and get to the West, where you could express yourself in any way that you can, you know. So I guess we sort of take for granted that we live in a society where you can make any sort of art that you want to, sort of criticize anything, where there were places like that where you were shut down for even considering writing a play about the GDR or something, you know. Yeah, there's also sort of human connection and sort of empathy, you know, highlights the way that acts of compassion and solidarity can sort of transcend these sort of ideological sort of barriers, hence why Weissler, he's sort of stuck in this system, but the more he sees like empathy and sort of these relationships happen, he starts to be sort of thawed by it, you know. So I really liked how that was a key theme. I could probably talk about the themes for ages, but it's just a very deep film, but it was very like controlled at the same time. Like it was fun to watch in a way, because it was so, I was never bored during the whole runtime. Like it was such an easy watch as well. And the ending got me. I nearly teared up at the ending. When he opens the book and it says, you know, to a good man. That was a criticism from, I can't remember who, I think it was another German director, who basically was comparing this, I think, to Schindler's List.
Oh, you took my point. Damn.
Oh, sorry. Comparing it to, I'll just say comparing it to Oskar Schindler, saying that Weissler obviously wasn't a real man. So like Oskar Schindler was. So how can you make a film about like a fake GDR officer who may or may not have sort of done this, where he regresses on all of his convictions and, you know, basically gives up being a Stasi, you know, because you don't know if there was even someone like that. But I think it's fine, because it shows, I think there may well have been, and it shows that a lot of Stasi officers were probably human at heart and they were stuck in the system. I think that's a fairly common sort of thought that, you know, could have happened. So I don't personally see a problem with it, but that's the criticism that I see, basically. Don't want you to expand on that, Jason. Yeah,
I knew I should have said that earlier.
Yeah, sorry. I should have let you take
the reins. No, that's all right. So, yes, I was sort of touching on expanding. Yeah, so it was from the opening scene, which is set in a prison. I'm not going to try and say the name of the prison because I can't pronounce it. But now the prison is a site of a memorial dedicated to the victims of Stasi oppression. But they didn't actually shoot the scene in the prison, because the director of the memorial refused to give the film director permission. And so the Narb, who's the director of the memorial, objected to making the Stasi man into a hero and tried to persuade Donnersmarck, who's the director of the film, to change the film. And Donnersmarck cited Schindler's List as an example of such a plot development being possible, and then Narb replied that that is exactly the difference. There was a Schindler, there was no Weissler. Which I agree with, but I think of something like, so the comparison I had, and it's funny because I just watched Schindler's List for the first time a couple of weeks ago, and I also gave that 4 stars. But I think of another film that actually you and I have talked about on the podcast, George, which again is more rooted in fiction. I mean, obviously Schindler's List, you know, it's like varying degrees. Schindler's List actually concerns a real person. The Lives of Others concerns real situations per se, but not a real people. But the film I was thinking of is something like American History X, which we discussed back on episode 41, where obviously there you have, but again, it's gradual. And I feel like there's a lot of similarities between that, in that obviously said, as we said, Wiesler does not, it's not a overnight thing where he suddenly decides, oh, I'm not going to spy on these people anymore. It's obviously gradual. And it's the same thing with American History X. You know, I think you and I touch on that, George, where I think you maybe felt it was a bit too sudden. Correct me if I'm misquoting.
Yeah, I remember thinking that.
Yes. Whereas I love that film. I thought that was like one of the best ever.
Yeah.
But I think one of the reasons I love that film is because it is. I think I did agree with you on the podcast where I said it does sort of happen for the sake of a story, like instantly. But it's sort of a similar thing where Derek, I think his name is, gets, you know, it's because he goes to prison and the guy he's doing laundry with is a black guy, and he's like, oh, actually, I don't need to be this white racist skinhead Nazi, you know, actually these black people are all right, you know. So it reminded me of that in a sense, where it was like once Wiesler was exposed to the people who he was surveilling and figured out, oh, they're actually all right people, that sort of then that change happened. Is that I do think, I know a lot of people describe, I do think American History X is a better film, but of course they deal with different things. And what I said, one is dealing with skinhead Nazis, the other is dealing with the stars that you are. But I liked that they both, the main characters in them both changed, and the changes felt realistic. You know, they didn't feel forced for the sake of a story, and they didn't happen like overnight. And then I have got a couple quotes, and then I will shut up and let you talk, Jacob. I have got a couple quotes I found from around the internets. One is talking about Wiesler's sort of transformation, and the other is talking about, I guess, just the film in general. So the first is from a website called The Story Department, and they said, it's some random site I found that was talking about it. So they said, since movies allow us to show character revealed by action, we can appreciate von Donnersmarck's choice to mark Wiesler's transformation by his profession. Initially, Wiesler's job is all secluded in an attic with earphones attached to his head, listening and monitoring the secrets of others. He sacrifices his career for the lives of George and Christa Maria. Still under the Stasi, Wiesler steams envelopes, but with Glasnost, Wiesler leaves the basement steaming room and soon serves his country and his countrymen as a mail carrier. No longer the isolated revealer of secrets, he now walks the streets as a deliverer of people's privacy. But Wiesler isn't the only character that grows in this story. He becomes a catalyst that triggers transformation in the others that he observes. Notably, George Dreiman goes from celebrated and loyal playwright of the GDR to activist against the system, and Christa Maria transforms from loving girlfriend to tragic informant. So I thought that was an interesting analysis of the of the sort of characters.
All the characters are, I mean, obviously Wiesler is the central one in a way, but each of them has their own sort of arcs. You know, they're all developed sort of equally as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and then another one I found was from the University of California, Berkeley, the Department of German. Was part of a film review as part of a multicultural Germany project, where they said, throughout the film, lighting is set up such that shadows are seen, paralleling the omnipresent covert surveillance of society by the Stasi. Regardless of position and relation to the Stasi, everyone in the movie felt observed and consequently acted as though they truly believe a socialist ideology. Through this charade, The Lives of Others elucidates another facet of prescribed and performed identities. While today debates surrounding performances and staging center around diversity and discrimination, the GDR imposed prescribed identities onto all citizens such that the prescribed and the performed were the same.
Mm.
So I thought that was
another good one.
analysis.
I mean, it is a film rich. You'll probably find hundreds of essays and, you know, reviews, and it's, you know, there's lots of things going on which we can't cover in just one episode. But yeah, I wanted to highlight as well the production design. Yeah, like the sort of set design. They did so well in getting the sort of 1980s East Germany. Not that I obviously was there in the 1980s East Germany, but from what I could, from pictures I've seen, and my mother was also living in West Germany, Berlin at that time. So she sort of got sort of glimpses of it and what it was like and the wall and stuff. And she was
had her on as a special guest in the podcast.
Yeah, historical context. She was there when the wall came down.
Wow.
She was dancing with all the West Germans and everything.
Wow.
So she was interested when I told her about the film.
Is she German?
Or... No, she just lived in Germany for years. So she speaks fluent German as well. But she's not German, no. But I thought all the Stasi headquarters, it was almost like, it reminded me of another film called Army of Darkness by Melville, where it's sort of like these headquarters of whether it's the Nazis or the Stasi, they're so sort of boring and dull and sort of almost like you're forced to conform to it because there's no character to it, if that makes sense. And I thought it sort of reflects the sort of drabness and uniformity of the socialist regime at that time. I thought all the costume design was amazing as well. The cinematography was great. I think cinematographer was called Hagen Bogdansky. I don't know what else he's done, but he did a great job. The sort of muted color palette, the sort of shadows like you mentioned, which sort of creates a sense of darkness, foreboding. Again, you mentioned this stuff, but yeah. I thought the sound design was also very good. And the score was a bit bit more on the basic side, that there was nothing about it that really stood out. It was a bit sort of maybe stereotypical drama, you know, like, but it was still good. And the final thing I wanted to mention was, it sort of reminded me of, there's a film I watched recently called A City of Sadness, by a Taiwanese director called Hao Hsen, I think. But it's kind of similar because that film is set in Taiwan in like the 50s and like the 40s and 50s, where there was also a party called the Kuomintang, which was like the mainland China nationalist party, which were imposing sort of martial law and authoritarian regime on Taiwan. So it's sort of also similar to the Stasi, and they were monitoring people, kidnapping people, you know, forcing confessions, forcing surveillance on people. And sort of both protagonists in both films are sort of under surveillance by both regimes. So I thought it just reminded me of that film, and anyone should check it out if they liked this film, because it sort of deals with similar stuff. This is a bit more sort of melodramatic, and the other City of Sadness is much more sort of understated, but they both deal with the same theme very, very well. I mean, I could probably ramble on about it for a while, but I'll shut up now. Jacob, is there anything you want to add, or have we covered?
You've pretty much covered a lot of it. While I did give it 4 stars, I think that Wiesler, he's, you know, while his acting was very, like, it didn't seem super dynamic through the whole duration of the movie, except for when he was, like, actually showing emotion, he's always just very sort of, like, focused and, like...
I think that's the point, though.
It is the point. But it's just, he was so good at that sort of, like, very serious kind of, like... It was like his face was mostly painted in that very... Yeah.
He's been beaten down by the GDR so much. He's, like, been beaten. He's like, I'm tired of this shit, you know? I just want to hug someone. He just wants a hug. He wants a hug. That's what he wants.
Well, I kind of wanted to hug him when he was emotional. But,
yeah.
And the scene...
I felt so sorry for him. When he was pretending to be hugged, I was like, oh, he's like a little...
The scene puppy. With the prostitute. That was pretty out of the blue when that came up. And then it made sense, though, because he was like, you know, he wanted some kind of a human connection, and that was a very easy way to do it, transactional way. And then he's like, oh, no, stay, you know, you're going to be late for your next client anyway, you know. So he really wanted to have that human connection. So I think that was a pretty powerful little scene.
It sort of links in another scene, which I found powerful, was when he goes into the bar and then Krista comes in and they have this conversation where he like says he's basically like a fan of her work. And he tells her like, you are an artist. Like you basically sort of, you shouldn't be suppressed. Like you are a great artist. And that's why I think he has a sort of soft spot for her and tries to, I think he's more trying to help her than he is trying to help Drayman, maybe. I don't know if that's an angle that can be explored. And that's why he's so upset, well, obviously, when she dies at the end, because that wasn't his intention sort of at all. But I love that scene in the bar when he talks to her. But yeah, that it's like their dynamic I find quite interesting, him and Krista. But yeah, it's sad actually. The actor Ulrich Mühl, I think he's called. He died about a year later after this film was released, from stomach cancer, which is kind of sad because he's a great actor, it seems. I think, what else have I seen him in? I think I recognized him. One sec, I'm just checking what else I've seen him in. Oh yeah, Funny Games. He's in Funny Games as the dad, which is a horrifying film. But I just found out quite sad. I didn't know he was only 54, I think, 55. But yeah, gave a great performance for sure. But yeah, I think all the performances were great across the board. Actually, I was going to say the reason I gave it 5 stars is because, like you said, I really couldn't. I couldn't fault it at all, you know, and I was sucked in for the whole film. Like I was zoned in, and I was enjoying it the whole time it was going, and yeah, I just couldn't find any really notable problems. So, you know, 10 out of 10.
Oh, that's pretty good. We're all in agreeance.
Yeah,
you know,
seems that way. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we all strongly liked to pick by the sounds of it. So. No weirdness, no surrealism, no art house, avant-garde, experimental, rubbish.
Yeah, nothing controversial,
really. Very straightforward, politically sound, you know, emotional, drama.
Next time, you've got to go for art before art house picks.
Hey, if you want me to shit all over your pick, I'm happy to deliver. I'm just warning you now. You need to know what you're in for. So it's your film. I don't care. Personally, it's not my pick.
I suppose even though I did enjoy the movie as like a pretty solid movie, that's what it was lacking though. It was lacking color and a bit more laughter, because there were some moments that were pretty like.
I know. So this is the thing. I've been to Berlin, right? And Berlin is a very grey, drab, miserable city. It feels like it's still stuck in the Cold War. So, yeah,
Jacob, I think any filmmaker that manages to make Stasi East Berlin, the GDR, a colourful place, you know, is the best director in the world. So I don't know about that.
To do that, they would. I'm trying to get the right words. Okay, so imagine right.
But why? The thing is, also, why would you
want to subvert?
Why would you want to do that?
To create a point.
Because
I'm sure you'd be able to make some point.
You're an agent provocateur. That's what you are.
The problem is, Jacob, you then get people who have like who had parents or grandparents who lived in East Berlin in the 80s and 70s, going, my granddad was surveyed for 10 years. Why is it being portrayed
because
as a
that
happy,
is the art
colorful
of it.
Place?
Because art is supposed to create a visceral, like a feeling. It can be super punk to do that, to subvert.
No. I'm not with you on
subvert
this,
in
I'm
an
sorry.
Artistic way.
No.
It's like changing Nazi Germany to like, you know, a beautiful, colourful place.
Yeah,
but people do
George
that.
And I won't agree. Now look, you've done the rare thing. You brought George and I together in agreeance. It's a miracle. Look what you've
people
done.
Satire. In satire, people sort of turn Nazi places into very colourful, weird, because they're trying to turn it into more of a pantomime.
Yeah, satire's, okay, yeah, I would agree, because there's a film called The Death of Stalin, and that's funny. That's a heavy satire. So that's, I with
or
you on
something
that.
Like Jojo Rabbit.
Jojo Rabbit, yeah. Yeah, I'm with you on that. But if it's like a, I thought, if it's like a straight, if it knows it's being a drama, a straight drama, I think there's like a responsibility to ensure that everything is portrayed as it would have been, you know.
Oh, if, 100%. You know, I'm not saying turn a drama into a very colourful sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Although I understand was a drama in film, I understand that in film you have to make it, you give it emotion through sort of the depth and colour, the blues, the greys, stuff like that. But did it really look like that?
Probably.
Probably.
So every day there was clouds and everything was blue. There would have been days that people came out. And there's probably films out there.
I'm going to say what you've said to me a million times. It's a film.
I know it's a film. I know.
It's a film.
What I'll say, though, I think is it would have been so tonally wild to have suddenly people having a wonderful time in East Berlin in this film, you know what I mean? Like, the tone was so perfect.
Oh, it was. I'm not arguing that it's not.
Because it's all about the suppression of the regime suppression, the depression of the time, the surveillance. If you had someone walking down the street doing twirls and dancing and laughing in a colourful dress, you know, it would have been so tonally different.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not saying turn like the drama into like a colourful sort of thing.
Yeah.
You backed yourself into this corner. You've got to fight to get out of it now, brother. Yeah, come on.
But then I'm fighting. But I still feel like even though it was drab, you know, on a warm, sunny German day, you know, there would have been more colour outside of film. But that would be an interesting portrayal. Imagine that. Like, it's drab, everybody's depressed, there's all this, you know, terrible shit happening. But there's still some people that are trying to find, like, some kind of enjoyment. And in that enjoyment, it is colourful. And there is more colour, you know. Because I think that's where some creativity can come from.
Maybe too. A compromise could have been some blue sky here and there during the film. You know, show some blue sky. And maybe show a scene where there's some people like dancing in a bar or something, or having a nice drink. Maybe that could have been a compromise. I don't know what you want from this.
Oh no!
I know what you mean.
I'm with George too.
We're all with George.
But
I just don't think it would have fit. I know what you're saying. I just don't think it would fit with the tone of this film. But I know what you're saying, how in East Germany in the 80s, there of course would have been people having a nice time, partying, you know, having some jokes, laughing about. But I think the general atmosphere is what they tried to capture.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm with you.
Yeah.
Generally.
But I guess the main reason that I sort of that provoked that thought is just that, as far as films go, I know that that's the theme and that's the intention. And it was all very solid. But I think part of the reason you guys have covered everything. And I think part of the reason that I wasn't super like energetic, you know, about talking about the film is because it
was so drab.
Good, but it was drab, you know. So, you know, some of my picks, or there's some other picks that are a little bit more dynamic.
Right. Okay.
Using the word dynamic.
Yeah. It's interesting. You know, I mean, you know me. I love dynamic, weird, crazy shit as well.
Yeah.
I also love when films aim for a tone or an atmosphere, and they nail it so well that I'm just sucked in. So yes, it was drab, but it was like drab. It was intending to be drab, you know. It was necessary to capture the atmosphere of East Germany. So I know what you mean. You didn't, you liked it, but you weren't fully on board with it because it wasn't like the vibe that you normally go for.
Yeah, pretty much.
But that's fine. Yeah, that's.
I know. I think I'm the thing I'm trying to basically get across is I gave it 4 stars. Thought it was great, but it's not the kind of
thing.
It's far too mainstream for you. Your taste skew far weirder than the lives of others. You want some weird surrealist,
I think, by
avant-garde, insane.
I like that as well, to be fair. I like that as well.
But I find that there is some pretty, like, sort of more boring...
I've
watched a hell of a lot of boring ones, that are supposed to be amazing.
But there are some that are sort of like pretty plain that I do enjoy. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. But the example I draw back on is like Army of Shadows. Is that what it's called? Have my mind gone blank? Yeah. Where that was so like the color palette is just so like muted and drab and dark, but it's like it's a masterpiece because it shows what it was set in, like Vichy France, when the Nazis controlled Paris. It's just everything's so grey, but it just captures the general sort of mood of the French people at that time, you know. So it's all about the director's intention, what they do with the mise-en-scene, with the colour, with the cinematography, with the shadows, whatever it is. So it's all about what they're trying to convey with that. But
I do understand.
I'm glad we got to the bottom of that. I love how that one comment just sparked like a whole session.
I say these things sometimes.
I was going to say, that's Jacob Zame. He just likes to make a single comment and just stand back and watch it all burn.
You just dropped a bomb and just watched it drop and explode.
But I just hope that like my random sort of like tangents through that whole tangent doesn't make me seem like someone that doesn't understand, you know, intention. But it's definitely good to unfold.
Yeah, I mean, you gave it 4 stars. You clearly did. Yeah, yeah. You clearly liked it. So I know. I totally understand you.
But I would have enjoyed it more if there was more color in it.
I think you're the sort of person who likes. You're the sort of person who likes deliberately provocative art. I think.
I do.
All right.
Watch the Greasy Strangler.
Yeah.
Draymond's flat had color in it. Draymond's flat had color. You know, it had red. It had the wallpaper. His bedroom, you know, there was colour in Draymond's flat. And that was actually the contrast between his flat and East Germany, right? Because his flat was a sort of like westernized flat. And then you have Wiesler's flat, which is all barren, dark, grey, no furniture, no paintings, you know. So it's like the contrast between his flat and Draymond's flat, which sort of the film is focused on, partly. So there's like a contrast there, right?
Oh, 100%, absolutely.
I think so. Your favorite part was the bits in Draymond's flat, is what we can ascertain, because there was color.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, they're banging and
yeah,
you know,
yeah. You should write the director an email, like a fan email, and say, by the way, in the lives of others, they should have been wearing more colorful, you know, colorful.
Yeah, like everything's drab and blue and stuff, but everybody was wearing really loud shirts.
Yeah, you need to lighten up.
Like Hawaiian shirts that were
Hawaiian shirts. Yeah,
every color of the rainbow.
Flowery dresses. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like really subvert. Like La La Land, really subvert like La La Land. The idea.
Yeah.
No. Like, or maybe you, like just or maybe you, go back you in can history
make
and just
you can make a remake.
I was going to say, you can make your own film.
Colourful drama.
Yeah, you can.
You know, and,
yeah.
Yeah. Or
you'll
get cancelled for making East Germany look like a colourful paradise.
But the fact that they would want to try and cancel someone for doing that would mean that it was powerful, right?
If you made it a satire.
Because even Jason was saying, oh, it seemed like a pretty uncommon film, you know. You said something along the lines of that, right? Like you hadn't really heard it previously, or you hadn't really seen it.
Yeah.
If
they were wearing more colourful shirts, right?
Well, this
was a cult hit, then I probably would be the one saying, "Hey, we should watch Lives of Others." Like same storyline and everything. And maybe she doesn't get hit by a car. She gets hit by like...
Survives. She survives in your version.
Okay. No, she gets hit by a moose.
A
moose just comes out of nowhere.
A colorful moose. Right, okay.
And it completely changed the whole meaning of it.
This is like an avant-garde surrealist version of The Lies of Others now. This is what it's turning into.
Sounds like fun to me.
Yeah, I'd watch it, Jacob. I would.
But I do respect the fact that he stayed very true to the vibe, the feeling, and the fact that it's a political thing, and that's a very, when things get very political, it can be very sort of touchy.
Yeah, that's a crux of it, isn't it? Like I was saying,
unless it's a satire.
Yeah, I mean Florian, what's he called? The director. Florian. Like, he did so much research, and as I said, his parents were from East Berlin. So he did so much research into it. There would be no other way that he would make this film, because he basically lived through it through his parents and did so much research into the Stasi and their methods. So, you know, there's no other way he would have made it, really. You know, as realistic as possible, with the drama added in, obviously. But yeah.
As far as surveillance goes too, you know, we're living in, you know, capitalist sort of society, but there's, I don't want to go too deep into that because I know that can turn into so much more of a conversation. But we're being surveilled.
Well, no one wants to be surveyed like that, you know. That's like, it just turns the populace against you, doesn't it? Because you lose trust.
Well, I mean, the technology they had back then, that's what they had. It was a bit more difficult to survey people. But now it's like basically in your pocket. But there is some legal clauses where they can only take so much information. But we're in that sort of... Apparently it inspired Edward Snowden, this film. I read somewhere.
Yes, I read that on Wikipedia. Yeah, it did. Can't remember the exact quote.
I won't offer my opinion on Edward Snowden for fear of being drawn into an even deeper rabbit hole than what we've gone down. But...
Yeah, sorry. Yes. Again, I'm just throwing the bombs.
You're an agent of chaos.
You're just dropping the bomb. I can't find anything.
That's why I'm here. But... You know, George has all the we've got someone running the show as well. Then I'm the one that sort of maybe comes in and sort of provokes some nuggets.
And you drop
and brings a little bit of dumb humor into it.
Yeah. I did love your colorful idea for the. I did love that idea. That gave me
joy. Hopefully the listeners find it funny. Hopefully they're not too. They get what I'm saying as well, or they probably listen up to that part and think no, and then they can't. They don't see my redemption arc, you know.
Well, I think on that note we will wrap it up, for fear of offending any more people. And next week, we've got our first sort of, obviously all our episodes are group episodes now, per se, but we've got our first sort of themed episode for the year as such, which is Hong Kong cinema, sort of picking up something. I think it was the first episode for the year, wasn't it? We talked about, we should do that as an episode, and we're doing it. We've brought it into reality. So we'll be talking about a few Hong Kong films: The Magnificent Butcher, Shaolin Soccer, Hard Boiled. That should be fun. George will be able to educate us on all things Hong Kong action cinema. Subscribe to us, rate us, review us. Thanks for listening. See you in Hong Kong next episode.